Welcome. This is Jay Thiemeyer for KBOO FM, Grassroots Alternative Radio in Portland, Oregon. I'm with Jenny Westberg, a local journalist and board member of the Mental Health Association of Portland. On August 19th, Portland Hearing Voices, with sponsorship from the Mental Health Association, is bringing our guest Bob Whitaker to Portland to speak at Powell's Bookstore. Bob Whitaker has been a finalist for the Pulitzer for his science writing in the Boston Globe and has won the George Polk Award for magazine writing. He has dedicated himself to the challenge of treating mentally ill people and challenging the pharmaceutical industry and their collusion with the psychiatric providers in pushing meds on the mentally ill. He is the author of Mad in America, that was came out in 2002, and his latest book, which will be the subject of his talk at Powell's, is Anatomy of an Epidemic. Everyone is welcome. That's August 19th at 7:30. Welcome from the listeners of KBOO, Bob.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure being here today.
Yeah, thank you. You concluded Mad in America on a positive note, and I'd like to read the concluding page of that. You said, furthermore, this is quote, furthermore, during the past decade, our society has become much more aware that academic psychiatry in the United States has, in essence, sold its soul to the pharmaceutical industry. Society no longer trusts what psychiatry says about mental disorders and its drugs. All of this may be opening the door, just a crack, to change. For instance, as I write this, I know of a major provider in eastern Massachusetts that is considering conducting a pilot project of Tornio Finland's, quote, open dialogue, unquote, therapy, eager to see if it will work as well there. The scientific literature provides news of an alternative model of care, one that involves using the drugs in a cautious, selective manner that is producing very good long-term outcomes and that provides rationale for change, unquote. Given that optimism for the future, what provoked you or prompted you to write Anatomy of an Epidemic?
What prompted me to write Anatomy of an Epidemic?
Yes.
Well, let me just put this in context a little bit. You read from an updated edition of Mad in America. So what happened is the original ending of Mad in America was much more pessimistic, actually. It basically said, it seems hard to understand where any sort of thorough reform might come for us, sort of a thorough rethinking of this drug-based paradigm of care that we're having. And then what you read for him was basically an updated edition. The publisher asked me to do an update. And the reason I was optimistic in that new edition of Mad in America is sort of an odd reason, to be honest with you, because it comes out of a sense of how society is recognizing that our current system of care is turning out to be such a failure. And I'll give you an example, and then we'll go on to how I came to write Anatomy of an Epidemic. But after Mad in America was initially published in 2002, since that time, and it deals really with treatment of people diagnosed with schizophrenia and serious psychotic disorders, but since that time, what has happened? We had a government-funded study called the CATIE study, which found that, A, the new atypical antipsychotics are no better than the old antipsychotics, so there isn't that step forward. And, B, the other thing is, if you really look at that study, it showed the drugs, that this form of care really wasn't working, because 74% of the patients couldn't stay on their drugs for 18 months, either because the drugs were ineffective or they found the side effects intolerable. So you saw in this CATIE study, A, an example of this centerpiece of our care today really wasn't working for the majority of people. That's one thing. The second thing, and I know this is again a sign of failure, but failure sometimes sets the stage for change. We got a study, and I think this was about 2 years ago, that showed that early death is really becoming a problem with people treated with antipsychotics, and we're talking they're dying 20, 25 years early. Now, that really caused people to wake up, because obviously this is a seriously bad thing to be happening. Third, there was a study by Martin Harrow, and Martin Harrow is a University of Illinois researcher. He's been funded by the National Institute of Mental Health, and in 2007, I think it was, And he's been following a group of schizophrenia patients since the early 1980s, and it's what's called an observational study. He's just been following this group of 64 patients and seeing how they're doing. And then he's also, and he, so he's checking them at a year, 2.5 years, 4.5, 7.5, 10, 15. And then he looked at whether or not they were taking medications, antipsychotic medications. And what did he find? He found that after, by year 4.5, there was a real split in terms of outcomes. And roughly 40% of those off medication were recovered and doing well. And more than 50% of those off medication were, in fact, working. Whereas only about 5% of those on medication, complying with the standard of care, were recovered or on or working. So we saw this recovery rate was 8 times higher for the off medication group. At the end of 15 years, it was the same thing. Those off medication were recovery rate was roughly 40%. More than half were working, whereas the recovery rate for those on medication was only about 5%. So this was a real wake-up call, too, because this is the best longitudinal study that we have, funded by the government, and it completely contradicted the common wisdom that people with schizophrenia need to be on drugs all their lives. And by the way, those on medication were much more likely to be actively symptomatic. So you add all these things together, and you can see really a failure with the common wisdom in terms of treating schizophrenia, and that we need to be looking somewhat differently. And maybe that, and given Harrow's study, that we should be rethinking how to use antipsychotics. And boom, now we have this program in Finland where they have been using antipsychotic medications with their first episode psychotic patients in a very selective, cautious manner since 1992. And they now have the best outcomes in the Western world. And in their program, only about 20% of psychotic first episode psychotic patients are maintained on the drugs regularly, and only about one-third, 5 years out, have ever been exposed to antipsychotic drugs. And what are their outcomes? 80% are back to work or in school 5 years out. So an extraordinarily good outcomes, and it arises from a very different use of medications. So anyway, this is the first half of your question. You add up sort of the accumulating evidence that our current paradigm of care that says, okay, people, you got to be on, anybody with this diagnosis has to be taking these drugs for life. That is a failed paradigm of care, increasing evidence of that. And then we have this beautiful evidence-based reform out there that says, aha, here's a path to much, much better outcomes. It's so clear, so powerful, that that's why I became optimistic when I rewrote this new edition to Mad in America, because you do now have people talking, including some people within academic psychiatry quietly, that maybe they really should be thinking of change. So that's why I was optimistic. Now, going forward to the second half of your question, how that led to right anatomy of an epidemic, here's what happened. So Mad in America was published in 2002, and that dealt with sort of the history of the treatment of seriously mentally ill. And then after that, people would ask me, well, what about bipolar disorder? What about depression? What about medicating children? How are long-term outcomes for those groups of patients? So I wrote a couple other books and sort of put this question aside. But then finally, I just looked at disability rates in the United States, and I looked at the number of people on disability that's receiving SSI or SSDI due to mental illness in the United States, and I tracked that forward from 1987 forward. 1987 is when Prozac arrived in the market, and we got this real upsurge in the amount of use of psychiatric drugs. And guess what's happened? Well, the number of disabled, quote, people disabled by mental illness in the United States and on government disability rose from 1.25 million in 1987 to 4 million in 2007. So right away, you can see the puzzle and the paradox. We're told how necessary these medications are for, say, bipolar, for depression, and how they fix a chemical imbalance in the brain. And so we embrace that paradigm of care. And what happens? Next thing you know, we see this rise in disability. Well, you shouldn't be seeing that if indeed this is an effective paradigm of care. Now, with children, the disability numbers are even more shocking. There were 16,200 children under age 18 on disability due to mental illness in 1987. Today, it's more than 600,000. That's a 35-fold increase. So the disability numbers at least raise a question. What's the reason for this rise in number of people on disability? And could it be linked to our increased use of psychiatric medications? And so I wrote Anatomy of an Epidemic to investigate that puzzle.
Right. That sounds powerful. I think I have a lot of respect for the fact that you're going up against the power, the corporate power of the pharmaceutical industry, colluding with the psychiatric apologists, and for you to take that challenge is remarkable to me. I think Jenny had a question.
Yeah, I do. Okay, Bob, first of all, I remember back in the 70s when I was in high school, and the whole nation was riveted by two reporters called Woodward and Bernstein. And I think you're at Woodward and Bernstein for a new generation.
Well, thank you. That's high praise, I have to say.
I'm really inspired to see how you follow a story, no matter where it leads, and you, and despite the consequences. So it's a privilege. To begin with, just following up on what you said about disability. On second thought, I'm going to ask you something else.
Okay. But I'm happy to also to follow up on the disability.
Sure.
You want to go on that?
And
go ahead.
We'll definitely get there. Could I ask you about informed consent and the right to refuse treatment? Now, it seems to me even if a psychiatric patient does receive information on the risks and benefits of psych drugs, it's basically coming from the drug companies. Is there really such a thing as informed consent in mental health care?
Well, that's a great question. Listen, I think this actually in some ways goes to the whole heart of one of the real problems we have with psychiatric care in this country. Imagine you're a heart patient, right? Or you have a pain in your heart. And you go to a doctor and he tells you you got a tiny hole in your heart. Well, he would only tell you that if indeed there was evidence for it, right? He would never lie to you about that he had seen something or that they knew something was wrong with you if they didn't know that to be so. But as you know, and we all know this, people for many, many years now have been told that they have a chemical imbalance in the brain, right? That maybe they have low serotonin if it's depression or too much dopamine. But more than this, they just are told, you have a chemical imbalance, and this drug will help fix that imbalance. Now, that's not true, okay? Scientifically, there's no question that's not true. There is, when they researched the chemical imbalance theory of mental disorders, they did not find, for example, that people with depression, as a matter of course, had low serotonin levels, and they did not find that people diagnosed with schizophrenia had high dopamine levels. And when they looked about how the drugs worked, they definitely did not balance those things out. So you ask about informed consent. Well, the first thing about informed consent would be to say to anyone who arrives and has symptoms, whether it be at a psychiatrist's office or at a mental health services place, is people should be told we don't know what's wrong biologically. So informed consent would have to begin with not lying and saying that people have chemical imbalances, that they have something physically wrong with their brain when we don't know that. And when I say we, I mean when the medical establishment doesn't know that. And we as a society don't know that. So informed consent gets off on the wrong track right from the beginning when people are told they have a known biological problem when that is not true. The second thing in terms of informed consent, there's two parts to this story. One is that there is sort of this marshaling of information together by pharmaceutical companies, psychiatrists, and academic medical centers in which they spin the data that even appears in the medical journals. So even if you're a doctor who wants to keep up on the information and who wants to be providing the benefits and risks to patients, it's hard to find out what those real benefits and risks are because the scientific literature itself is corrupted. The flow of information is corrupted. And there has been this sort of storytelling chorus come together in the United States, and the chorus consists of pharmaceutical companies, psychiatrists at the top academic centers, the NIMH and NAMI, that really is dedicated to telling a story about how wonderful drugs are and to minimize the risks. And so that influences what, in fact, is just known by the population as a whole, what gets reported in scientific journals, et cetera. So that's the second problem of informed consent, is that there isn't an honest flow of information into scientific journals and into the public. And I'll give you in a second a great example of that. And then third, you do have a problem that I think that people who've ended up, you know, being diagnosed and treated will verify over and over again, is that the side effects from drugs, both short-term and long-term, just aren't discussed that much, or they're sort of given short shrift. And especially some of the long-term side effects, of course, are really troubling, and those I don't think are discussed much at all. So bottom line in terms of, is there informed consent when people come in to a psychiatric setting, get their initial diagnosis, and talk to about the benefits and risks of the drugs? I don't think there's anything close to informed consent going on. And I think that's one of the real tragedies because, obviously people need information to make wise decisions. And I think the basic respect for people is, you know, they get to make the decision and they need to have all the information. And let me just give you one example of one which the public is kept from information that might unsettle common beliefs. Martin Harrow published his results in 2007 that found that recovery rates for schizophrenia patients off meds was 40% versus 5% for those on meds. Went completely against common wisdom. By the way, he was also following a bipolar group for 15 years as well in that study. And the bipolar patients off meds also did much, much better long-term than the bipolar patients on meds. So this is our best long-term look we have at outcomes in the United States. It's funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. Now, when those results came up, did the American Psychiatric Association issue a press release and alert the press to this information? No. Did the National Institute of Mental Health, NIMH, issue a press release? No. Did National Alliance for Mentally Ill issue a press release? No. Did they put this information on their websites? No. As a result, did these important results appear in any American newspaper? No. They were hidden, they were covered up, et cetera. So when you have that sort of flow of information in which bad news in the sense of it doesn't go to standard beliefs, is covered up and kept from the public, well, you do not have a public as a whole that even has informed consent. And so, Jenny, what I'm saying is your question is right on target of, in some ways, what I think the biggest problem is, and that is we do not have free flow of information, honest flow of information about what is known about psychiatric disorders and what is known about how they affect long-term outcomes at all, and that's why we have such a big problem.
Okay, Bob, I want to also ask you about the element of coercion. For instance, when patients are in a locked psychiatric facility, they will often be told, basically, if you take your medications, you can get out or get out sooner. And I think Jay has a related question about forced medication.
Yes. In yesterday's New York Times, there's an article about in New Jersey, the state was being sued over the forced medication of patients at the psychiatric hospitals. And there's a nice quote from the litigation director of Disability Rights of New Jersey, and the disability rights organization in Oregon is excellent as well. Quote, as a patient in a state hospital, it's your legal right to refuse and go through a process, but you get severely penalized if you try, unquote. What is your feedback or what is your thought about that kind of dismissal of rights in the psychiatric hospitals?
Okay, another good question. I'm just going to repeat it here because I was having a little trouble hearing you. You're basically saying that even though people may have a legal right to refuse medications in hospital settings or in outpatient settings,
they're penalized.
That they can be a lot of pressure to, in fact, be forced to take the medication, correct?
Right. There's coercion, there's force, where, in fact, in any other area of medicine, be charged with battery for treating a person against his will.
Right. Well, okay, another great question. I mean, this is something that has bedeviled psychiatry for a long time, forced treatment. And we can go back to forced treatments of many kinds, forced electroshock. In essence, there was sometimes coerced lobotomy, I would say. You know, certainly force metrazole, insulin coma therapy, shock therapy. So anyway, force therapy has been a problem within psychiatric settings for a long, long time, persistent problem. In some ways, I think it's worse today than it's so prevalent today. And it's prevalent to, so a couple things here. Where does it arise from? It arises from this sense, of course, that people who are, quote, crazy don't know what's best for them, and therefore, without any legal proceedings, really, the state or the powers that be can, in essence, decide what's best for that person. And while we may have, maybe there's been these tiny legal protections that you do have a right to refuse medication, you really don't have a right to refuse medication if you're in a hospital setting and basically you're going to get punished for not taking that medication. That punishment can come in many forms in terms of whatever, denial of privileges, people being unhappy with you, it's that you're not going to be allowed to get out, all those things. And as you know, we have these outpatient laws as well now, outpatient commitment laws, that really once you're in those outpatient, you're in that legal setting, there's a lot of pressure to take medications in those settings as well, or else next thing you know, you lose your services. So I think this is wrong for a couple really essential reasons.
It was interesting in the same article to read the response of NAMI, the representative from the National Alliance on Mental Illness for New Jersey, that they felt that since the person was incarcerated or committed, was clearly a danger to themselves and to others, that this person did not see forced medication as a major issue, whereas another person speaking for the Mental Health Association of Essex County in New Jersey said, quote, "The state is way behind the times in this forced medication. It suspends people's civil rights without due process, and it's troubled him for years. It's an ongoing problem," as you mentioned.
I mean, I think there's a couple of things here. One, it is a suspension of civil rights. I mean, first of all, they're going to do something to your brain, right? And there is no real due process. And it's amazing to me when you get in this corner of the world where you get designated a psychiatric patient, there's no question to me that you have fewer rights than if you're charged with a crime. So when you're charged with a crime, there are some protections for, you know, what goes forward. The loss of personhood that comes sometimes with a psychiatric diagnosis or psychiatric whatever, when you're seen as, you know, in that position, it's astonishing. You basically lose your rights. They go out the window real fast, and it comes from when you just see that with the NAMI ideas, that they're not able to appreciate their need for medication. But it clearly, an extraordinary thing to be forcing medication on people, especially things that affect their brains. So in terms of if you do think civil rights are important, that's an extraordinary thing to happen. Second of all, when you talk to people who've been in that position, so often it sets things off on a very bad course, because in medicine you often see that what really works is when there is some sort of sense of trust between those providing the care and between those, quote, receiving the care. When you have forced medication, you break that potential for doctor-patient bond right away. So that's a problem as well. And then number three is what we're talking about is in fact, if you look at some of the responses people have to medications in the short term, there might be some very good reason they don't want to be shot up with antipsychotic medications. It can be a very rational thing, response. And the second thing is, if you look at long-term outcomes, there's plenty of reasons for people to not want to be on the medications long-term as well, so because it may not be working for them. So, in fact, that can be a rational response. So, I mean, I think this is it's a very big problem for the system. It's a moral problem. It's a civil rights issue. And let me just say one thing. Could it be different? And one of the things in Anatomy of an Epidemic, I went to this place in northern Finland where they get real good outcomes. Now, one of the things that would happen there, let's say with a first episode patient, they never force medication on people. Never. On that first medication, and that first episode, they even try to avoid talking about whether medications are needed, because they actually try to avoid use of antipsychotics. But when they decide, when medication comes up, it's like a joint decision. The doctors will talk about it, the therapist will talk about it, they'll ask what the patient thinks about it, and the patient has to consent.
Right.
The patient has to say, yeah, I think I need this for whatever reason. It'll help me sleep. It'll help me feel less anxious. I want this.
Bob,
and now, so there's a system they found to do it where they don't have forced medication. Their outcomes are great. So when you get NAMI or someone saying that it can't be done, well, why can they do it? And why can they do it? And so why can't we do it?
Well, along that line, there are alternatives, like the Tornio Finland open dialogue therapy that you just mentioned. Yet, obviously, you need funding, and in these down times when states and localities especially are facing budget cuts, I see, you know, a diminished likelihood that unfamiliar policymakers, politicians who aren't really familiar with the literature and about alternatives are going to fund what they would probably consider iffy or experimental programs that might be extremely more beneficial to a mentally ill person than the paradigm that we have now.
Right. Here's why I'm a little optimistic on that. In general, Jay, I agree with you. They're not going to fund it because, it's just not a group that has much immediate political power. I mean, actually, I think they're getting people who've been in the system are ending up with more power, but at least a little bit of power. But here's where I think that there can be an opening for change. Is the current system is failing on such a grand scale? And think about those rising disability numbers. Well, U.S. spending on mental health services doubled from 2001 to 2008. They went from $85 billion to $170 billion. State budgets are being stretched like crazy because of all the expenses related to the psychiatric medications and also the expenses related to these rising disability numbers. And actually, a lot of also expense related to people who've been on the medications for a long time, they end up with a lot of sort of physical comorbidities. That becomes a problem as well. So I think the reason there might be some opening for change even politically is because this current system is proving so expensive that people say, aha, we need to do something differently so we can get people, you know, that 19-year-old that, quote, has a psychotic break rather than funnel on that person, he or she, onto a lifelong career as a mental patient on disability. We need to have a system that gets that person back into sort of regular life. And so I think that financially maybe that will open the door to some reform and some change.
I want to mention here that you'll be speaking at Powell's Bookstore at 7:30 on August 19th, and we're really looking forward to that. And there's a lot of information that you introduced here that's available on the mentalhealthportland.org website, which is the Mental Health Association. That's mentalhealthportland.org. That includes also Madness Radio, Will Hall's show. Recently, a couple of weeks ago, he interviewed you about some of these same topics, same aspects of the major problem. I'm concerned about kept populations like inmates and vets coming back, in fact, dealing with the VHA, being plied with medications. And if you could give some insight into that, because I'm concerned about the soaring suicide rate among returning vets, for example.
Right. This is a great. Well, you're opening up a lot of things here about kept populations, et cetera, or wounded populations. This a little bit goes back again to this whole pathologizing of certain groups of people, right? And actually, in essence, placing the blame on people who've ended up in a bad position in society. Let me start. I'm going to go with a different kept population, then I'll move to the vets, because I think the vets is really key. Look at foster kids in this country, right? Now, what are foster kids? Foster kids are kids who got a raw deal in life, so to speak, in the lottery of life. They're born into a family that clearly is dysfunctional, and then they end up wards of the state. So what are we doing? How are we dealing with foster kids today? Well, most of them are getting psychiatric diagnoses as if it's their fault, okay? As if they have broken brains or they're mentally ill, as opposed to this social breakdown. And when they get that diagnosis, of course, it comes with medications. Now, they're not, there's no informed consent there, et cetera. And those medications, I think it's quite clear, are being used for behavioral purposes to sort of knock down behaviors, make kids less aggressive, or at least that's the hope, the thought of it, make it easier for foster homes to handle these kids. So, A, that's a response by society. Rather than try to really help foster kids and really sort of get them back on a path to a full adulthood, we're pathologizing them. We blame them as opposed to really look at the social breakdown.
And
so that's one
example
you're talking about.
There is an alternative, too, the Seneca model.
Oh, absolutely. Of course there's. It's amazing to me that somehow we can be reaching the year 2010 and not understand that troubled kids can be dealt with without medications. And what you're talking about, as one of the programs I went to in California, is called the Seneca Center, a residential program. It's run, by a psychiatrist there who, for years, the first thing he does, he takes all the kids off the medications. Now, of course, if they arrive at Seneca Center, they failed. The kids that arrive there basically are considered the most troubled kids in Northern California. They've failed on the drugs, so that's why he's allowed to take them. And his name is Tony Stanton, off the medications. But what happens when he takes them off the medications? Well, lo and behold, those kids are able to now start forming bonds with mentors, emotional bonds with mentors, emotional bonds with other kids. And one thing Tony Stanton says that I think is so beautiful and true, he says human beings, and especially children, need to be in relationships to organize themselves, to sort of understand their behaviors and gain control of their behaviors and gain this perspective on their self and have this sense of self-agency as well. But you can't do that in isolation, and obviously you need your mind to do it as well, and you need to be able to form these emotional bonds. So are there alternatives? Absolutely, no question about it. But what we need as a society is to embrace those. But now let me go forward to your other two questions about, say, the same thing is happening in prisons. So many people today in prisons, and by the way, I used to work in Attica Prison. I worked in a prison called Attica Prison in upstate New York in the late 1970s, and this was after the riots there was a riot at Attica Prison. It was considered one of the more difficult prisons in all of New York State. There was very little pathologizing of the prisoners at that time. They were seen as people who had maybe done things wrong or been involved in things that were done things wrong, including murder, including horrible things, sold drugs, etc. But they were seen as criminal, people who had done something criminal as opposed to being mentally ill. And you want to know something? Those people were, by and large, quite easy to deal with. I was a teacher there. So this new pathologization that we have, again, it's of an institutionalized group. We're now saying these people are mentally ill. They got these things. We put them on drugs. That's one more burden on them as they try to return to society and make something out of themselves. Now look what's happening to the vets. First of all, the vets in this particular time, what we're doing with the vets is, as a society, I think, astonishingly wrong. And by that I mean is these people are getting rotated back and back through one tour after another. So it's not like they go and do a time of, in being in a wartime situation for a year, year and a half, and how extraordinarily difficult and stressful that must be, and then come back and try to recover. They have to go back for a second tour, a third tour, and clearly that's taking a toll. And now when they come back, okay, what's our response? We now say they need, well, by the way, they're getting meds even while they're there, but we're saying you have PTSD, and that can be dealt with medications, and now they're putting down on this path of being, quote, a mental patient as well, as opposed to maybe trying to deal with in a psychosocial way, the extraordinary upheaval they've been through. And what you're also referring to in terms of the suicides we're seeing on vets, well, let's remember when they did the tests of antidepressants, of SSRIs, they did see some increased risk of suicide with going on those medications. So you have to ask, is that one of the reasons we're seeing all these vet suicides? But again, it's part of this sort of, rather than recognize the experience they've been through and the difficulties they've been through, and yes, the trauma they've been through, and with the sense of, like, how do we provide a sort of psychosocial repair system? It's like we give them a pill, call them mentally ill, and And next thing you know, you're sort of setting them on this path of being a mental patient.
And Bob, you mentioned drugging children, and you went into that a great deal in Anatomy of an Epidemic. Now, in June, in the American Journal of Society, Dr. John Gilmore and colleagues published an article that claimed to be able to identify schizophrenia in babies just a few weeks old. And Gilmore sort of optimistically said, this should lead to the opportunity for very early interventions. Are we going to start drugging newborns?
Well, first of all, I know that study, and I'll talk about the study, but this just tells you a little bit about how insane the whole discussion has gotten, okay? Remember, a newborn brain is developing, the youth brain is developing, and do you really okay, so we have that thing to remember. Two, I can go into this. The outcomes, long-term outcomes for medicated children, and of course we began doing this in 1990, are horrible. Okay, you're not seeing kids, say, diagnosed with bipolar, being put on these cocktails and then doing well 5 years later. You're seeing them do horribly. Okay? But now let's even go back to this Gilmore study. And this goes, I think, to how insane the society is on this whole topic. And frankly, psychiatry a bit is. Okay. That study, it found, it was in mothers with schizophrenia. These mothers were on antipsychotic medication. Okay? Now, at least the male babies supposedly had abnormalities in the size of their brains, and I forget exactly what the abnormality was. The females did not. And so what Gilmore says, maybe this is a sign that they're sort of schizophrenic at birth, and therefore, indeed, we can start then having a treatment for that abnormal brain. Two things. It's very likely that the reason you're seeing that abnormality at birth, or at least a good possibility, is because the mothers were on antipsychotics. So in other words, that's part of what you want to actually investigate here. Are we seeing something that is genetic? Or in fact, are we seeing something of sort of iatrogenic damage to the fetus because the mother is on antipsychotics? That's number one. Number two, there is good evidence that in adults, and actually in kids as well, that antipsychotics do cause morphological changes in the brain, including shrinking the frontal lobes. So it makes sense that it's possible that that was transferred to the fetus. But here's the final thing. Mainstream psychiatry brings up these points of, say, enlarged ventricles and sort of shrunken, a little bit of shrinking of the frontal cortex as an example that schizophrenia is a neurodegenerative brain disease. But those studies are generally done in medicated people, and B, there's good evidence that at the very least the drugs, in fact, exacerbate that process. So when they talk about treatment, well, you'd have to have a treatment that, rather than exacerbate it, stopped this problem. But this is why the conversation is so crazy, because look at that study. They don't talk about the possibility that the drugs are causing the problem in the fetuses. Number two, they hint at that this will lead to treatment that will somehow be good for that abnormality. And third, they're hiding the fact that the treatments we have today, in fact, best evidence is they cause brain shrinkage. So much is missing from that story that's told to the public. And why is it missing? Because the only parts that were heard is little bits of pieces of information that is meant to advance the story that biological psychiatry is making all these advances, get research for dollars flowing, and really expand the market for psychiatric services. I mean, this is the medicating of children and younger children is one of the it's hard to imagine anything that's gone more wrong in our society than that, than the widespread medicating of children and young children.
Well, I have one question to conclude. Racial disparity in diagnosing and medicating, and as an aspect of that, the people being detained by the ICE for possible deportation, including legal aliens who are dealing with mental illness and winding up being deported. But first, that racial disparity. Could you address that, please?
Jay, I miss you. You're asking me to address the racial disparity in diagnosis and
Yeah, there's a racial disparity in diagnosis. For instance, more black people are labeled schizophrenic rather than bipolar, even if they have the same symptoms. And right. then there's disparities in that it's difficult to find a black provider in the mental health system.
Sure.
There's problems, I'm sure, with early diagnosis, over-drugging, institutionalization, homelessness.
Right.
And then we've got a NAMI response. They've got a multicultural program. But basically, from what I've seen, it looks like they want more people of color on drugs.
Right. Oh, listen, first of all, yes. Historically, and there was a great study done on this in the 1980s that looked at racial bias. And basically, of course, it's white physicians doing the diagnosis. And what they found was same symptoms, that if you were a black male, you were much more likely to be diagnosed schizophrenic as opposed to if you were a white male. So that is well known and well understood. And you are actually seeing it now with bipolar in a different way. When initially it was sort of, the way the whole juvenile bipolar thing has evolved has been a little bit odd. I mean, it first happened with some white middle-class kids getting that diagnosis, and they initially had the ADHD diagnosis. But then what happened is, as sort of it became more popularized, it's now really being applied to black children a lot, and especially black males. So, and you see why there is this racial bias and this class bias, because if kids who in some ways are under societal thumb as juvenile patients in foster homes or perhaps in juvenile institutions, there's no questions that diagnosis plus heavy medication can be used for behavioral purposes, curbing aggressivity, that sort of thing. So, and what you're really raising here is the question of this line between, is psychiatry a medical discipline for, treating known medical disorders, physical disorders, or does it sometimes become, in essence, a type of social policeman? And the social policeman is with foster kids, is with people in prison, whether it be illegal aliens. And once you get into that, of course, social control element, race and class certainly enter the equation. And I think it's fair to say that with the expansion, of the use of atypical antipsychotics, and think of that word, antipsychotics, theoretically it's for people with psychotic symptoms. Well, clearly the extraordinary expansion of the use of those drugs into various populations is not because they're psychotic, but because it's being used for behavioral purposes. And when you see that, you're definitely starting to get into the arena of social control. Of course, it's being, and here's part of the dishonesty, it's being pitched as medication. It's being pitched as treatment helping this person. That's a whole chemical imbalance story. But talk to a lot of the sort of younger men and younger women who are being put into that category against their will, and they don't see it as being treated for disease at all. They see it as, social control.
Bob,
and it's a type
Bob,
of social control without rights.
Bob, we're going to have to conclude there. With the ultimate beneficiary being the pharmaceutical industry and the stature of the psychiatrist. And there are going to be a lot of questions, I'm sure, on August 19th at 7:30 at Powell's Bookstore. And we're really looking forward to talking with you some more. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you so much.
It's been wonderful. Thank you again.
Thank you.
This is Jay Thiemeier and Jenny Westberg speaking with Robert Whitaker, the author of Anatomy of an Epidemic. We're KBOO FM radio in Portland, Oregon. Thank you.